Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Sarah Dykstra. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear about the expected passage of Sunday alcohol sales. Brandon Smith talks about the creation of a special legislative study commission to investigate the Department of Child Services. Sharon Jackson reports about a gun show protest. And John Kane, host of Eye in the Arts, talks with Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. As expected, Hoosiers will be able to purchase alcohol on Sundays starting this weekend. With the stroke of his pen Wednesday, Governor Eric Holcomb signed a bill easing the state's Sunday blue laws.
There is absolutely no need any longer to make a run for the border if you're a Hoosier or a Hoosier at heart.
The bill goes into effect immediately, so this Sunday, Hoosiers can pick up their preferred alcohol from noon to 8 p.m. House Speaker Brian Bozema says more changes are in the works for alcohol reform.
This will be the first of several, no doubt, revisions to the alcohol code.
The bill was approved by the Senate last week, 38 to 10, and it does not include some provisions others still want, including the ability for sellers other than liquor stores to sell cold beer. You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. After decades of debate, Hoosiers will finally be able to buy alcohol on Sundays, starting this weekend. Governor Eric Holcomb signed the bill into law Wednesday, February 28th, but IPBS's Barbara Brosher reports the battle over alcohol reform in Indiana is far from over.
It's a weekday morning at the beverage shop in Ellettsville, and the store has a surprising number of customers stopping in. It sits on a busy stretch of State Road 46. General Manager Adam Selinsky says that makes it a prime location for people passing through town.
We get a lot of people that really come through on Sundays that don't understand why Indiana doesn't sell alcohol on Sundays. So we miss out on a lot of money, I feel.
That's about to change. The beverage shop and liquor stores across Indiana are getting ready to be open on Sundays, starting this weekend. Selinsky says he'll reassign employees to work the new shift, but the biggest change will be in revenue.
We've got two stores. We're in really good locations. I don't have much grocery competition, so it's just an extra business day for us.
Not being able to buy alcohol on Sundays is something Hoosiers are used to. Jason Lancer is assistant director of the Honors Program at Butler University. He's written two books about prohibition and says the restriction dates back until that time, when states decided to enact their own alcohol restrictions following prohibition's repeal.
What becomes an anachronistic is that Sunday sales don't come back before 2018. The length that we hold on to no alcohol sales on Sundays.
Lancer says Indiana ending its ban on Sunday sales signals the end of an era. But there's another decades-old alcohol law where the state is still a holdout: cold beer sales.
It's going to be who gets the public behind them and sort of forces the issue.
The owner of Ricker's Convenience Store says that's exactly what he plans to do. Jay Ricker helped spark the Sunday sales change after using a loophole last year to sell cold carryout beer at two of his locations. Legislators worked quickly to close that workaround and promised a comprehensive review of alcohol laws. Then the Indiana Association of Beverage Retailers and the Indiana Retail Council came together and asked the General Assembly to legalize Sunday sales, while at the same time requesting they keep the sale of cold beer in convenience stores illegal. And that's what happened.
That business has been protected for many, many years, and they haven't had to change and innovate.
Ricker says he just wants the competition to be fair, allowing liquor, grocery, and convenience stores to sell the same alcohol at the same temperatures. He doesn't think the state legislature should be in the business of determining what industries should have an advantage over others.
We need to have the ability to sell what our customers want. And it's not just that we'll get more beer sales. What it really does is lift our store sales inside.
Governor Eric Holcomb did acknowledge during his bill signing this week the debate over cold beer will continue.
We'll cross that bridge when we come to it. And there's good news is next session is right around the corner. So we'll be prepared to continue to look at ways to modernize.
That's something that worries Selinsky back at the beverage shop. because cold beer makes up more than half of his sales. He says the business will survive if the legislature eventually expands cold beer sales, but others may not. Selinsky says that's just part of the competition. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. A Senate committee unanimously recommended Monday, February 26, the creation of a special legislative study commission to investigate the Department of Child Services. Democratic Senator Eddie Melton authored the resolution. He says his proposed two-year commission is not meant to interfere with an ongoing independent review of the embattled state agency.
I think this is a great opportunity for legislators to remain engaged in this process.
The original resolution listed causes of the recent surge in DSC cases. They included poverty, substance abuse, and crime. The Senate committee stripped that language out. Melton supports the change. He says he wants the commission to be as open as possible.
I ensured it didn't leave out any other contributing factors to children. So I think the most important part is to make sure we have the committee established.
The resolution now goes before the full Senate. You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. A local activist group who called themselves Faith in Action will be protesting outside of a gun show at the Lake County Fairgrounds this weekend. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson has more.
A local activist group who call themselves Faith in Action will be protesting outside of a gun show at the Lake County Fairgrounds this weekend. The group is from the First Unitarian Church of Hobart. Maggie Reister, who serves as president of the Board of Trustees for the church, says Faith in Action will be putting its name into practice with a peaceful demonstration.
The protest involves the First Unitarian Church of Hobart Faith in Action Committee, the Progressive Democrats of America, Calumet Region, and Progressives in Action, Northwest Indiana. The protest is against assault weapons.
Reister says the group, like many Americans, were stunned at the last mass shooting of a school, killing children. And Faith in Action wants to get their message and their concerns out to the public.
The question just hangs over our country, what to do. And it's very frightening, it's upsetting, it makes people angry, and so we clash with our right to bear arms, which of course is a constitutional right, and we really want to have a conversation about common sense, sensible gun laws, things like banning assault rifles.
The group wants the issue of private sale loopholes to be addressed. They also want background checks to be strengthened. They want to influence existing laws that serve to protect us and our children. Reister emphasizes that Faith in Action is a peaceful, friendly activist group.
They call themselves Faith in Action because that's one of the things that Unitarian Universalists believe in, is putting our faith into action and standing up for justice in the world.
Reister says the group's protest will be a peaceful event, which will showcase people's right to protest, and all involved want to be respectful and courteous of one another. For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Republican leaders halted gun bills to avoid debate. Lawmakers sought to address DACA recipients getting job licenses. And the governor made alcohol law history. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the week at the State House.
Republican leaders say they halted gun bills in each chamber this week to avoid debate on several gun regulation proposals. There were proposed amendments to the gun bills on everything from banning bump stocks and assault weapons to barring those on the terror watch list from possessing guns. Senate GOP leader David Long says the amendments were purely political and designed to force embarrassing votes. The House this week took steps to ensure recipients of the federal immigration program known as DACA will be able to receive and renew professional licenses. The Professional Licensing Agency recently changed its applications to better comply with a 2011 state immigration law. The move meant thousands of DACA recipients were barred from professional licenses. An amendment approved in a House committee will allow people to receive licenses as long as the federal government allows them to work, which is DACA's purpose. And the governor signed into law this week legislation to allow Sunday alcohol retail sales for the first time in state history. The measure takes effect immediately. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. Carl Lissick, host of Green Fleet Radio, which is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, talks with Doyle Sumrall, managing director for NTEA, the Association for Work Truck Industry. You can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Well, thank you for that introduction. And today our guest is Mr. Doyle Sumrall. He's the managing director for the NTEA, the Association for the Work Truck Industry. Doyle, welcome to the show.
Hey, Carl. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Doyle, tell our listeners, what is the NTEA?
Carl, we're a trade association, mm-hmm. Located in Michigan headquarters. We are all aspects of the industry that are trucks built in multiple stages. So the plow trucks and the delivery trucks that come to your house. We've got a little over 2,000 members, and we've been around since 64.
Wow, that's a long time. So what are some of the trends you're seeing in the work truck industry, Doyle, when it comes to sustainable transportation options?
You know, it's really interesting. I think we've seen electric as a real push by the last administration, and then this administration has kind of dropped off in that regard. But industry itself has continued. We learned a lot with hybrids, mm-hmm. and one of the really impressive things that came out of hybrids was workplace operation with the engine off. And a lot of people call that EPTO.
Okay.
But it really goes well beyond that today, from powering basically lights when a truck's sitting on the side of the road to operating the bucket of the crane electrically. It has a lot of following. It's got good traction in the industry. The traction drive, full electric trucks are a little more challenging. It takes a lot of power to move a big work truck around, and so we're not seeing that come on as strongly as perhaps maybe in cars, but some hybrids. The other thing in a recent study we've just done, we see a real interest in biodiesel. So diesel, as we know, is say 65-70% of the sales and might be 80% of the population out there. And by going to biodiesel, you have a green bent on that. It's a little better for the environment. And it's pretty smooth. I mean, you don't have to change a lot of things in your operation. And you get that range and power that you need.
Sure. No, that's exciting stuff, Doyle. And I know there's, we read every day about some of the challenges that are facing the work truck industry's move to sustainable transportation. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Sure. Trucks for industry are a tool. It's very different than your personal car. You buy a car, you buy it with personal preferences and maybe a little bit of lifestyle choice.
Mm-hmm.
For professional businesses, they're buying a tool. And so these are specifically tailored to their needs. And that becomes, whether we like it or not, an economic decision. It's part of their competitive edge in the industry. Certainly being sustainable has a market value as well. But with fuel being very inexpensive, it makes the payback on some of these technologies a little more challenging.
Sure. So I know you have one of the biggest and one of the best events that we attend. It's the Work Truck Show and Green Truck Summit coming up in Indianapolis this year. So tell our listeners a little bit about that event.
Well, great of you to ask about that, Carl. And you're right, we're in Indianapolis. It's going to be March 6th. We'll do the Green Truck Summit, which is an all-day event. Focuses on sustainability. We're very fortunate this year as the keynote. We have Terry Schaefer, who mm-hmm. is the strategic general manager for Daimler Trucks. This is a follow-up to their top engineering guy, Wilford, who spoke last year. They're going to talk a lot about where they're going and what they're thinking. And we'll follow on with the thing that we had last year, which was an effective and efficient path to zero emissions. And this year, there's going to be a lot of presentations, a lot of insights around what the industry and fleets are doing in this low-fuel environment to continue their sustainable march. We're seeing a lot of good things, a lot of electrification of systems, deployment of the fuels technologies, as we were just talking, and a number of other things. The work truck show itself, we are blessed to have about 11,000 industry professionals attend, hundreds of trucks on the floor. Your organization is going to be doing a meeting there, and I think that's going to be very interesting. And, of course, we've got the IDEM folks from Indy. We're going to talk a little bit about the VW funds that are coming out. So you and I could spend an hour talking
about
all we can do there.
Well, you know, I think the interesting part, though, Doyle, is I think, you know, this event is open to everyone, anyone that's interested in any trucks. If you have any questions, you know, who are some of your followers of this, Doyle? I mean, basically, it's anybody that wants to drive a work truck. You know, are you still doing you're going to still have the ride and drive event? And, you know,
absolutely. Ride and drive is going to be a lot of fun this year. Workhorse is going to demonstrate their Horsefly drone delivery technology three times a day on Wednesday and Thursday. We have six or seven OEMs doing new truck reveals. We get several thousand fleet managers there looking at this new equipment, talking about their experiences with fuels and equipment, and, of course, hundreds of trucks on the floor. The ride and drive as you know, get you the opportunity to go out and actually get hands-on and drive one of these vehicles there on the Indy streets and learn about the technology from the professionals. So just an awful lot of really exciting things happening this year.
Sure. And it's definitely an international show held right here in Indianapolis. So how do listeners learn more about how to find out about the Work Truck Show and Green Truck Summit?
Well, if they go to worktruckshow.com, they'll find all of the schedules, everything about what's going on, who the key speakers are, and, of course, they can connect with your organization and get a prepaid pass that will get them into the show at no charge and allow them to go to one of the concurrent educational sessions. So I think going to your Clean City site or to the Work Truck Show site, both will provide them with a lot of information.
And, you know, Doyle, we're really looking forward to this event. We love working with you and your organization and all the different members of the NTEA. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Doyle Summerall, Managing Director for the NTEA, the Association for the Work Truck Industry. And Green Fleet Radio airs three times every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. John Kane, host of Eye in the Arts, talks with Kirk Muspratt, music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Kirk Muspratt, back with us to talk about the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra's third and final classic concert of the 2017-18 season. Kirk, this is a concert that's coming up at Bethel Church Auditorium in Crown Point on March the 16th. Can you please tell us about it?
Well, I'd be happy to, John. Mm-hmm. First of all, I have one of the members of the Chicago Symphony coming to play the Mozart Clarinet Concerto. It was written just a few months before the end of Mozart's death, and still, to this day, it is the most famous and important clarinet concerto in the world. What's interesting about it for me is that at the time, the clarinet was not really an instrument that people played. And so for Mozart to write this amazing and beautiful and touching piece on this instrument is rather amazing to me just before he died, just a few weeks before he died, it was premiered. And my J. Laurie Bloom, who was one of the clarinetists from the Chicago Symphony, is coming to play that piece for us. So we have some Mozart, and people are always asking me for Mozart. On the other end of the spectrum, John, mm-hmm. we have Tchaikovsky, and we're doing from two of the great ballets, of course, Sleeping Beauty and Swan Lake. We're doing the two suites from this. And, you know, what's really interesting to me, John, is that the Chicago Symphony this year is doing both of those suites at some point with Riccardo Muti. So we must be doing something right, you know, with our programming.
it's beautiful music.
Oh my gosh, it is gorgeous.
It's the best. I love those suites. But you also have programmed something quite unusual, something called a tango mass. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Yes, thank you, John. Yeah, this is by Bakalov, Luis Bakalov, who is the Argentinian composer who writes so much film music. You know, if you know that great and heartbreaking film Il Postino, it's that kind of music. And because he's Argentinian, he wrote a mass, so it has a sanctus and a Kyrie and all that. But they're all written in the style of a tango. Mm-hmm. So we have two soloists and the chorus, and we have a bandoneon player, which is like the Argentinian accordion playing. Mm-hmm. And it's very exotic and beautiful and sensual, and yet it's still a mass. Mm-hmm. You know, it still is using the text of a mass. It's very unusual, and you know, the chorus gets to sing with us and be there with our two soloists. So hopefully it's a diverse, interesting, and you know, we don't want our audience to be bored. That's for darn sure.
Now, I managed to acquire a ticket. I went with one of my cousins to a concert 20 years ago, one Friday night at Orchestra Hall in Chicago, and Daniel Barenboim was playing the piano, and there was a bass, I believe it was a trio, and it was a bass player, and how do you say the accordion instrument, bandoneon?
Bandoneon.
Bandoneon. Yeah. I have to see it written out so to know how to say it right. But anyway, it was an evening of tangos, Argentine tangos, and it was so beautiful. They had CDs available, and I bought one in the lobby at intermission. And I played it to death. I mean, the poor little jewel case of the CD is just cracked, and it's barely hanging on. But, oh, that boy.
It makes sense, actually, with Barenboim, because he was born in Argentina, mm-hmm. and he has that enormous affinity for all of that music. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and it is, again, very sensual, and, you know, it's tango. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, it was beautiful. And yeah, so audiences will really enjoy that, I think, especially. Well, great. So that's on Friday, March the 16th. That's our final classical concert of the season. Then we have our Pops concert in the spring in May, which will be performed in two locations, at Bethel Church once again, and then also at Highland High School's Monbeck Auditorium. And those dates are the Friday and Saturday of Mother's Day weekend.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
I say these things tentatively, even though they're all set. Everything's set. But originally, of course, that was going to be at the Star Plaza Theater, which is no more. So, all right, Kirk. Well, thank you for being here to tell us about the concerts. And thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update from Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm Sarah Dykstra. The ballots are set, and the countdown is underway to the May 8th primary elections. Lake County Elections and Voter Registration Director Michelle Fayman was on Regionally Speaking to talk about the next step in the election process, challenging positions in the ballot in this year's primary.
On the 27th, we will hear challenges to candidacy. So that's where an individual citizen or another candidate is challenging a candidate based on the qualifications to hold office. And so we have approximately 28 of those. Majority of them are for precinct committeemen. Some are for delegates, and then there are a few for the major offices. So once that deadline passes and we find out all the individuals, will they remain on the ballot or will they be removed? And then we'll start the ballot preparation for the upcoming election.
Are there any real reasons why some of these people are being challenged for those particular seats?
In some of the cases for the precinct committeeman, it's based on party affiliation or voting history. Mm-hmm. There's been a few challenges for people that may not have resided in the precinct at the time of filing for office. They were doing the transfer or they just didn't live there. So those are a couple of the reasons for the challenges when it comes to committeemen and delegate. There are a few for major offices where they're, one, either indicating that someone filled out the form incorrectly or that they haven't filled out some campaign finance information.
Yeah. So this, there are reasons that at least have to be reviewed, I'm sure.
Exactly. Yes. And so that's why the challenge process takes place. They'll come before the election board, which is made up of five members. They will hear both the person challenging and the challenger and the challenged candidate will both have an opportunity to speak and state why they should either be removed from the ballot or why they should remain on the ballot. The board will make a decision, hopefully, on that day, and then we'll move forward again, like I said, with the ballot preparation, so that we'll be ready for early voting, which at our Tuesday meeting, the board did approve. We will have our 11 early voting sites that we've had in the past. All 11 will be in place for the 2018 primary election, and voting in those locations start on April, I think it's 10th.
Oh, okay.
Which is a Tuesday.
Yeah. So is it becoming more and more popular now for people to take advantage of the early voting opportunities? Like you mentioned, they can start in here on April 10th?
Yes, it's been growing year after year after year. People like the convenience of, one, being able to go to any of the facilities, any 11 facilities. It doesn't matter where you live. If you're driving down Indianapolis Boulevard and you drive past the St. John Township Assessor's Office, stop in there and vote. If you're over in Gary, you can stop at the Genesis Center and so forth. Also, the other thing that's very convenient for the voters is on Thursday nights, we're open till 7 p.m., so that's very convenient for any of our voters who maybe work out of the area, possibly up in Chicago, and don't get home till after 6 p.m. It gives them the opportunity to go and cast a vote on the actual voting machine, and people prefer that sometimes over the ballot card. So it's been a great feature for us. We're very proud of it. We are one of the only counties that have this many. I think we are the only county that has this many early voting sites.
Oh, really?
Yes. I mean, when you look at Marion County, which is the largest county in the entire state, I believe they only have one.
Oh, my goodness.
So with us being the second largest and having 11, it speaks real volumes to our board, our bipartisan board, who strives to make voting accessible to the voters of the county. Also, the great thing for Lake County is we also have two dates for Saturday voting, which is also very convenient for voters who may work all day, you know, during the week, that on Saturday when they're running the errands, that they can also go and vote either on Saturday, April 28th or May 5th, that we have voting on those days also. So that is also a nice convenience factor for all the voters. Also, people can vote by mail. So
that's right.
We've already started accepting applications. So if you're out there, you do have to meet some qualifications, but there are many qualifications on there. Some of them go as far as, you know, one, that you might be over the age of 65, you may have disabilities, you might be out of the county on election day, and a great one on there now is that you may not have transportation, and so many of us are in homes that maybe only have one or two vehicles for maybe four or five drivers, and on any given day, you may not have that vehicle. And so that is also one of the reasons for voting absentee. We, like I said, we are accepting applications already, so people can submit those. We will begin mailing ballots as early as, I believe it's March 24th. So if anyone submits an application now, you know, that'll be in the mail, again, as early as March 24th, giving them the opportunity to cast a vote there. We also have where we go out to people's homes for people that are confined or caring for a confined voter, and that's called Travel Board. And that's where we send a bipartisan team, a Democrat and Republican, to the voter's home or where their facility is that they're confined. So we've got lots of nursing homes in Lake County. And we vote them. We take an actual voting machine with us, too. And the voter will get to cast a vote right on the actual voting machine. So that's a nice feature that we also provide for our voters.
We're talking with Michelle Fehman, who is the director of the Lake County Elections and Voter Registration Office in Crown Point. And it's going to go back here to the ballot for the Republican and the Democratic parties in 2018 for the primary elections here. Michelle, if you will, give us an idea of some of the major races that folks will get to see on the ballot when they either do their absentee voting or they go to early voting or actually show up on Election Day.
So we have a couple federal offices on the ballot. So we have United States Senator and United States Representative. We have some state races that are on the ballot, so we have state senator running in certain portions of the county. All of our state representatives are running. We also have, on the local level, we have our prosecutor, our clerk, county auditor, county treasurer, county sheriff, which is a hot topic right now, county assessor. We have one county commissioner on the ballot. We have all of our county council. And then we have a lot of, every township is running this year. So we have township assessors, trustees, and board members. We also have a few various towns that are up this year where they stagger their terms. And so for the town offices, we have Cedar Lake, Dyer, Lowell, Schererville, and St. John.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have precinct committeemen and delegates to the state convention. So on the Democrat side, we have precinct committeemen. The Republicans stagger their term, and so they, for committeemen, won't run until 2020. So if you're asking for a Democrat ballot, you may see Democrat precinct committeemen on there.
We have several school districts that are looking to ask their voters for asking some referendum questions, and we know that there are two, at least two, that are on the ballot here in the primary election, aren't they?
Those two being Crown Point and Lake Central School Corporation will be asking for a referendum on the ballot, which has been approved and everything looks to be in place for that. So if you live in those two communities, you will also see a question on the ballot. For those that are registering to vote, keep in mind you can be 17 years of age and still vote in the primary election. You must be 18 on or before the November election, which is going to be November 6th. So for anyone who is, you know, 17 years old and you're thinking you can't vote, again, as long as you're 18 by November 6th, you can register and vote in this year's primary.
For Lakeshore Update, I'm Chris Nolte.
That's Lake County Elections and Voter Registration Director Michelle Fayman. Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program's link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure to search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Sarah Dykstra.